The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering iPhone and iPad repairs, including liquid damage, cracked screens, failing batteries, and other issues. More information at techserve.com.
We are back at the Wynn Resort in Las Vegas in the presidential battleground state of Nevada for the first Democratic debate of the 2016 campaign.
We're going to win because first we're going to explain what democratic socialism is. It is wrong today in a rigged economy that 57% of all new income is going to the top 1%.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no,
no, no,
no, no. I'm a progressive, but I'm a progressive who likes to get things done as First Lady, as a senator from New York, and as Secretary of State.
Every girl crazy about a stardust man.
And after 15 years of executive experience, I have learned how to be an effective leader.
Always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die.
I'd have to say the enemy soldier that threw the grenade that wounded me, but he's not around right now to talk to.
You're looking at a block of granite when it comes to the issue.
Well, that does it for this Democratic presidential debate.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And in the first Democratic debate, there was a search for a new identity for some of the candidates. Centrist Hillary Clinton was steering her huge, some might say difficult-to-maneuver container ship into progressive waters.
I think that, like most people that I know, I have a range of views, but they are rooted in my values and my experience. And I don't take a backseat to anyone when it comes to progressive experience and progressive commitment.
From centrist to progressive last night for Hillary Clinton. Bernie Sanders, though, preferred the rapids, and in his kayak, he stuck to democratic socialism.
What democratic socialism is about is saying that it is wrong today in a rigged economy that 57% of all new income is going to the top 1%.
They like to kayak up there in Vermont. Meanwhile, Martin O'Malley's canoe got rocked by questions about his record as mayor of Baltimore, the crime-ridden city famous for starring in The Wire.
We've saved over 1,000 lives in Baltimore in the last 15 years of people working together, and the vast majority of them were young and poor and black. It wasn't easy on any day, but we saved lives and we gave our city a better future, improving police and community relations every single day that I was in office.
Rhode Island Governor Lincoln Chafee seemed to want a fireside chat about bank regulation. Here he is explaining his vote to repeal Glass-Steagall.
The Glass-Steagall was my very first vote. I just arrived. My dad had died in office. I was appointed to the office. It was my very first vote.
Are you saying you didn't know what you were voting for?
I just arrived the Senate. I think we get some takeovers. That was one. It was my very first vote, and it was 92-5. It was the reconciliation.
With all due respect, what does that say about you, that you casting a vote for something you weren't really sure about?
I think you're being a little rough. I just arrived at the United States Senate. I'd been mayor of my city. My dad had died. I'd been appointed by the governor. It was the first vote, and it was 90-5.
But former Virginia Senator Jim Webb was, you might say, on a slim surfboard, and he kept ending up in the water, and he wasn't happy with the amount of time he had in this debate.
With respect to the financial sector, I mean, I know that my time's run out, but I mean, in speaking of changing positions on the positions on how this debate's occurred, it's kind of frustrating because unless somebody mentions my name, I can't get into the discussion.
You agreed to these rules, and you're wasting time. So if you would finish your answer,
we'll move on. I'm trying to set a mark here, so maybe we can get into a little more later on. This hasn't been equal time.
There was a parallel debate, or call it the tweet nut gallery, responding to everything that was going on in the debate. Here's some examples. Ezra Klein, editor-in-chief at Vox, tweeted, Bernie Sanders is causing Merriam-Webster searches for socialism to spike. Sideline tweeter Jeb Bush tried to be the master of the obvious. It's clear the Democrats on stage tonight are running for Obama's third term. Join me if you're ready to stop them. Donald Trump tweeted notes as though he was the judge from a game show called America's Got Talent. All are very scripted and rehearsed. Two at least should not even be on stage. Sorry, there's no star on the stage tonight. Sideline tweeter Governor Mike Huckabee went for laughs. Didn't quite get there. Marijuana question appropriate. Democrats smoking it if they think their policies will save this country. Or I trust Bernie Sanders with my tax dollars like I trust a North Korean chef with my Labrador. Don't know if that worked, Mike. Todd Zwillick, not a word on the metric system. You people owe Lincoln Chafee an apology. Thanks for that, Todd. James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic, wrote, "This is true of everyone, but dramatically true of Hillary Rodham Clinton tonight. The more jokey, relaxed, and playful she was, by far the better. Hillary's laughs were an asset." Matt Ford, also from The Atlantic, wrote, "Bernie Sanders promises some huge, classy, really impressive taxes for Donald Trump." 538, Clinton scandals were the subject of as many questions as immigration policy. Many different ways of analyzing this debate, many different ways of looking at it. Joining me now with more is Democratic pollster Anna Greenberg. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Anna. What did you see here?
Well, I saw a couple of different things. Overall, a very different field than in the Republican debates. A much more respectful, less racist, less misogynistic, very substantive. So I think overall this debate was extremely helpful for not just Hillary Clinton, and we can talk more about that, but for, I think, Democrats in general going into next year, a general election.
So would you say Democrats in general looked at the candidates or looked at Hillary Clinton and said, okay, we're on track here?
I think both. I mean, look, you can pick apart the performance of the individuals, and obviously people like Lincoln Chafee and Jim Webb had some not such fine moments. But I think overall, even if you don't like Bernie Sanders' style, like yelling into the microphone, for example, if you look at the content of what he was saying and the content of what Hillary Clinton was saying and the content of what Martin O'Malley was saying, it was very substantive, very progressive. And, you know, you talked about that tweet about an Obama third term is actually quite different, frankly, than Obama's economic agenda, for example. It was much more populist, a lot of attacks on Wall Street. What the media likes to do is pick apart the individual performances. But when I look at it as a pollster thinking about how the general election is going to shape up next year, there's just a huge contrast between these two fields on the Democratic and Republican side.
Let's talk about the notion of centrism as something that, you know, is maybe more important for the general. And as is always the case, candidates are going for the extremes or the more ideological voters in the primaries. Is that what you're seeing here? And that the liberal tone is for the primary process, or are these the positions of these candidates all the way to November, if they should make it that far?
I think if you look at the range of positions taking on that stage, and again, there were not huge differences among these candidates, that those are going to be the issue positions they take going through next November. Let's face it, Democratic policy positions are much more popular than Republican policy positions. It doesn't mean Democrats win elections, to be clear, but if you look across a range of economic issues, for example, taxing the rich, or if you look at social issues, gay marriage. You look at guns, if you look at the range of issues that they talked about on almost every one, most Americans tend to agree with Democratic positions. I don't really see there'll be any need on the part of any of those candidates. I mean, obviously, I don't think some of those are never going to make it very far, but there really isn't any need to moving to the side. I think Republicans have a much bigger issue around their base and sort of the positions they take, particularly on immigration. When you talk about a general electorate that's increasingly Hispanic, I think they've got a much bigger challenge around moving to the center. I don't really see, if you look at Hillary Clinton in particular as the front runner and the likely nominee, I didn't hear anything from her last night that suggested, wow, she's out of the mainstream and she's going to have to move to the center. If anything, you know, it's the Republicans that have that problem.
Contrast the sense of Clinton fatigue, if such a thing exists, with, as you've described, you've alluded here to the extraordinary demographic advantages that the Democratic Party has on all levels, whether we're talking about African Americans, Latinos, urban voters, younger voters. It seems as though for the first time in many, many election cycles, the primary process does not have to skew to the left to actually attract voters, that it can remain in this left to center kind of middle zone and stay pretty stable between now and November. That's suddenly a huge advantage for the Democrats, it seems to me.
I think that's right. But to go back to your earlier question about Hillary Clinton and fatigue, I think we need to remember we've had months of email scandal, quote unquote, scandal coverage that has been quite damaging in terms of her personal standing and sense of whether or not, you know, she's honest and trustworthy. But recall that she was hugely popular as First Lady towards the end of the Clinton administration. She was popular as a Democratic candidate for president. She was unbelievably popular as Secretary of State. And so what we've all sort of forgotten, right, how much people loved Hillary Clinton because we've had this sort of single-minded focus on her and email and Clinton Foundation and the like for the last, you know, 6 months. And what happened last night is people remembered, oh, right, she's smart. She's funny. She knows what she's talking about. She's presidential. Oh, now I remember. I believe her favorability ratings overall, and particularly among Democrats, will get higher after this debate. I think people have forgotten that they liked Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State and when she left office.
The ghost of Biden?
I think that I have a lot of respect for the vice president and particularly his very strongly and authentic and genuine populist views. But I do think it is difficult to figure out how he plays a role at this point in the primary electorate. And I think that she probably rebuilt her standing well enough among Democrats in the debate last night and presumably in subsequent debates that it makes it hard for him to find some room.
Anna Greenberg, Democratic pollster with Greenberg Quinlan Rosner Research. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Gun store owners may have a free hand under the Second Amendment with few restrictions, but the issue of a retailer's liability did come up in last night's debate.
Do I think that a gun shop in the state of Vermont that sells legally a gun to somebody, and that somebody goes out and does something crazy, that gun shop owner should be held responsible? I don't. On the other hand, where you have manufacturers and where you have gun shops knowingly giving guns to criminals, or aiding and abetting that, of course we should take action.
So are gun owners and retailers actually concerned about liability or the simple tragedy of knowing that a gun they sold was used in a serious mass crime? Royersford, Pennsylvania. This person doesn't really focus on this issue, but says to defend ourselves against people who wish to do us harm. After all of the school tragedies, I am seriously thinking about getting a gun permit and a gun. If I feel more people were carrying non-concealed weapons, there might be less idiots trying to kill large groups of unarmed citizens. I hate guns. I've only ever shot guns twice in my life at targets, and the reverberation makes me cry. But I am willing to get over my dislike of guns to protect myself and my loved ones. Well, Steve Walsh is the owner of Ruby's Guns in Ellisville and Sullivan, Missouri. He's been a longtime gun owner and professional shooter and has been a gun retailer since 2007. What do you think of all this, Steve? Do liability exemptions enacted by pro-gun legislators make your business more complicated?
Well, many of the gun shops I know for a fact throughout the state of Missouri are very cautious about the way we do sell guns. There are all types of things, indicators that we can look for to try to make sure that the guns that we sell or sold to professional people and or just recreational shooters or folks that just want to purchase one for the means of defending their families. However, there are indicators out there that sometimes people fall through the cracks.
What about someone who seems to be emotional, who seems to be a little bit nervous? And I don't mean nervous in the sense that gosh, Steve, I don't know anything about guns. Could you show me some stuff here? You know, that kind of nervous. I don't think that kind of nervous probably bothers you at all.
No, not at all, John. That's very common. We do have people that come into our shop on a regular basis, and I mean regular every single day, that they want to purchase a gun. They don't know anything about it. They're asking for assistance. I put them in touch with the local police detective who will give them training as well. And they are really, really concerned. They're curious. It's no different than if someone was learning to drive for the first time. They have to learn.
Now, what about someone who gives you the heebie-jeebies, but they fall into this area where it's in fact legal for them to buy a gun, and it's up to you to kind of put your foot down as a retailer and say, you know what, I don't care what the law says. I'm not selling to you today. Please leave.
That does happen, and it happens a lot. I have the last call. I'm the one that's standing there at the counter. I'm the one making eye contact, talking to them. getting a sense of where their mental state is. And if something does not feel right, and it has happened on numerous occasions, that gun does not leave my shop. In fact, what we do is when we do a background check, and I always insist that whenever somebody is in my store and they just give me this nervous feeling, I'll insist that they fill out a background check. If I can get them to fill out the paper, then I have record of who these folks are. They will never leave my shop with that gun. We'll do a background check, and even if the background check came back okay, I delay them. We don't take money from them. I put them in a delay status, and there's been, on several occasions, I've contacted ATF, which is Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and gave them a heads up on something that just wasn't right.
Mr. Walsh, hi, how you doing? I love your shop in here. It's really, really great. I'm from New York, but I got some friends in Ellisville. My family actually lives here. I don't have a lot of time. I need to buy a 9mm Glock and a couple of clips and some ammunition. Can you set that up for me? I got really about 5-10 minutes here. How can we do that?
It would never happen. Being from New York City, I would just it just wouldn't happen. The first thing that would happen is say, well, you would need to go back to your own hometown to make a gun purchase like that. Generally, when people come in a antsy mental state of mind, something's not right. We have had people that have actually tried to make a gun straw purchase for us because the gentleman was attempting to kill a police officer from St. Louis, and it was intercepted. And it was intercepted because this man came in our store. We interviewed him. We knew something wasn't right. He went back out to his vehicle, took a picture of the gun he wanted, and a young lady came in our store from the vehicle he just got in, and she looked at her phone, pointed to the one she wanted, and we said, okay, that's fine. Fill out this piece of paper. She filled out the piece of paper. We put her in a delay status, contacted ATF and the FBI, and it stopped it right there. Hmm. Other gun shop owners need to do the same thing. You know, there are some gun shop owners, I guess you would say, that they're not as cautious, but I think people would actually be surprised how legitimate most gun shop owners are. They really are. They try hard to make sure things like this happen. But when we're dealing with human nature, there's always a way to get around it.
But politically active, politically motivated, maybe you might call them bad apple gun retailers, give you a bad name.
One gun shop can give everybody a bad name, but it only takes one. But it's just not gun shops. It's individuals out there in general that are intentionally buying guns, and they don't care who they sell them to. They'll go to auctions. They can go to gun shows. They can buy them over the internet. And that's the worst indicator, is when they make purchases over the internet.
Steve Walsh, I really appreciate talking to you.
Same here, John.
Steve Walsh is the owner of Ruby's Guns in Ellisville and a soon-to-be-opened Ruby's Guns in Sullivan, Missouri. He's been a longtime gun owner and professional shooter, been a gun retailer since 2007. Best of luck to you, Steve.
Thank you very much.
Does the gun industry bear any responsibility for the way its products are used and distributed? In the case of alcohol sales, a store owner who knowingly sells to a minor can have a license taken away. If a crime is committed with the alcohol, there is further liability. And if an older person buys booze for an underage person, there's the doctrine of contributing to the delinquency of a minor. And if a store owner knows about it, there's even further liability. Gun stores are curiously exempt from these tests, at least in theory. Two police officers and the city of Milwaukee are suing a gun shop for two officers being seriously injured by a gun owned by an 18-year-old, too young to buy a gun from Badger Gun Stores, who instead paid a 21-year-old acquaintance to buy the weapon for him. It's a practice known as straw purchase, and a number of cases, including the one in Milwaukee, which a jury began deliberating this week, are seeking an end to it, potentially changing the relationship between gun owners and the consequences of the products they sell. Timothy Litton is a law professor at Georgia State University and an expert in tort law and gun cases. He joins me now. You can read more about this in his book, Suing the Gun Industry, A Battle at the Crossroads of Gun Control and Mass Torts. What is the state of liability for gun owners and for the people who sell guns in the commercial setting?
Well, in 2005, the federal government passed a law that grants immunity from civil liability for gun manufacturers and retail stores for any kind of injury that arises out of a criminal misuse of the gun in a shooting. So up until that point, there had been a sort of steady flow of lawsuits by gun violence victims who sued not only the perpetrators, but also against gun stores and the gun manufacturers for their distribution and sales practices. The immunity law in 2005 really put an end to those lawsuits. There are a few exceptions to the immunity, and the case in Milwaukee in which a jury yesterday awarded damages, about $6 million in favor of the two police officers who were shot, that judgment was a judgment that was rendered against a gun store that sold the weapon. That falls under two particular exceptions to the immunity bill. The first of those exceptions is if the gun store violates a federal law regarding the sale of guns in the course of the sale. And the second is what's called negligent entrustment, if they negligently sell the gun to somebody who poses a high risk of harm. And the jury found both of those things to be true. And as a result, there was really the first verdict since the immunity bill in favor of a shooting victim.
How difficult would this be if there wasn't video evidence of both purchasers being in the store, and if there wasn't evidence of the clerk who just basically was selling a gun to a 30-year-old and had no idea that he was going to hand it to a 15-year-old once he got out of the store?
Well, if there hadn't been evidence of either, you know, knowing violation of the federal law or evidence of negligence, you're just talking about a gun store who used reasonable care, or there was no evidence that they didn't use reasonable care in the selling of a weapon and that weapon is misused, then even without the immunity bill, they wouldn't stand to be liable, because you're not liable for conducting legal business and then someone going away and misusing the product that you sold them. So if you're a car dealer and you sell cars and they're used in getaways or drive-by shootings, you're not liable for that.
So it is the case that if someone comes in who's of proper age, who passes a background check, but acts in the store and there's video evidence of it, of saying, man, I am so mad, and when I get out of here, I am going to really show some people who's boss. And the store owner kind of says, well, whatever, don't be a nut. Here you go. See you later. That technically does not violate any federal law.
I mean, that would be up for a jury, right? A jury would have to decide whether or not the behavior of the gun purchaser was such that the clerk knowingly sold the weapon with knowledge that it was going to be misused in a crime, and that's something that could go to a jury. But there may be differences or nuances between coming in and saying, I want to buy a Glock because I'm going to go shoot the police officer on the corner, or I want a gun because I'm really mad and I'm going to do some damage.
Lots to think about there. Thanks so much, Timothy Litton.
My pleasure.
Timothy Litton is a law professor at Georgia State University, editor of the book Suing the Gun Industry, A Battle at the Crossroads of Gun Control and Mass Torts. The Israeli military has deployed hundreds of troops in Israeli cities to back up police forces encountering a wave of deadly Palestinian shooting and stabbing attacks. Further inciting tension, Israel's security minister says the bodies of Palestinians killed by Israeli police would not be returned to their families. 8 Israelis and 27 Palestinians have died in a month of Israeli-Palestinian unrest. Noga Tarnopolsky is a Jerusalem-based reporter. Noga, on this program yesterday, former Ambassador Martin Indyk suggested that a third intifada was taking shape. It was going to take the form of stabbings and unarmed brutality to make the point that being so closely entwined, Israelis and Palestinians cannot live together unless something significant changes.
Well, you know, third intifada have become really the buzzwords. I would say much before this uprising even started, everybody has been waiting for third intifada. I'm not sure. I'm not at the point where I would say that yet. An intifada, which is a real uprising, would mean a massive, to me, a massive popular revolt. And that's not what we're seeing. What we are seeing is an eruption of young, frustrated Palestinians launching kind of individual attacks that are frightening for Israelis, but cause a limited amount of real damage and don't threaten, you know, even the daily lives of Israelis, really. And we're seeing the Israeli government respond, in fact, as if it were the second intifada, which was an organized and armed uprising. So my feeling is that we're sort of leaderless on both sides, and that's always dangerous. But I'm not sure yet that this is going to spread into being, you know, a massive social movement.
Is there a generationally driven frustration driving this, in the sense that the first intifada that I covered was the reflection of a generation that had absolutely been frustrated with nothing happening in most of their lifetime, and these were 20 and 30-year-olds. Similarly, a new generation exploded in the 1990s, and now we're, you know, a similar period of years away, and it's a different form, a different group of youths who are involved here. Do you see that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, in terms of the gap of years and mounting frustrations, that's absolutely true. But there are also significant differences. What we're seeing now is much more individual. We're talking about an infinitesimal part of the Palestinian population. We're not seeing right now a national revolt among Palestinians. What we're seeing is a few hundred young people, among whom a minority are willing to really be violent, get up in the morning and instead of going to their electrician's job, attack a soldier with a screwdriver, or two guys get on a bus and try and hack, you know, passengers with a cleaver. Yesterday we saw something that did scare Israelis more, which is an East Jerusalem resident who worked for the Israeli National Telephone Company used his car to ram into a number of Israeli civilians standing by a bus stop. And after his car stopped, because it crashed into the bus stop, he got out of his car with a cleaver and started hacking people. Two people die. I think two people die there. So these things are frightening, but they're incredibly individual. So if we start seeing that there are eight of these attacks a day for a sustained number of days, then my response to you would absolutely be, yes, what we're seeing is a generational revolt, exactly the kind that you described. And today, we've basically had a very quiet day. There have not been attacks. My profound hope is that people are tired of it and afraid. And again, I don't yet feel a massive revolt underway. And I think many, many Palestinians who are furious at the Israelis and very frustrated with their own leadership, which is, these are almost universal feelings, I think they still feel that they've got something to lose and that they are not willing to enter a state of war in which they would lose a tremendous amount right now.
Noga Tarnopolsky is a Jerusalem-based reporter. Noga, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Guantanamo Bay, that theme park of suspected terrorists, a suspended U.S. Constitution, and the open-ended detention of dozens of suspects for 15 years in some cases, without even being charged with crimes. I'm not exactly telling you anything you don't know. But what if Gitmo World came to your neighborhood?
We are going to get it done. But part of the challenge that you have is that you've got a bunch of folks who've been detained, many of whom may be very dangerous, who have not been put on trial.
President-elect Barack Obama talking about his promise to close Gitmo back in 2009. None of that is an argument for a travel brochure, and finding a city willing to take in these detainees not exactly has caused mayors and city managers to stand in line to accept the new Gitmo World. The prospect of using the disciplinary barracks at Fort Leavenworth, for instance, as the new prison site was a non-starter for the people of Kansas. But now the Pentagon has set its eyes on Colorado as a potential location for Guantanamo North, the Federal Correctional Institute in Florence, Colorado, which is home to Ramzi Youssef, already mastermind of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, and Unabomber Ted Kaczynski. Joining us now is Florence City Manager Mike Patterson. Mike, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So is this an opportunity for economic development or something else?
No, we don't really see it as an opportunity for economic development. Our area has lots of prisons and they are an important part of our economy, but we have some much bigger reservations about this.
But isn't it somebody's responsibility to take this on?
Possibly. That's a debate that is obviously going to go on throughout the country. From our perspective, if in fact they make this happen here, we are definitely very concerned about the security issues and what that means for our community and for the safety of those who live here.
Do you have a lot of prison breaks already with the facilities there in Florence?
No, we're not terribly worried about the prisoners themselves. The Department of Corrections and Bureau of Prison staff are able to handle the prisoners. The only prisoners who truly, quote, escape are the minimum security prisoners who walk away. You don't, generally speaking, have any other kind of prison breaks, at least around here. We're much more worried about what comes from the outside of the prison, not from those inside the prison.
So terrorist sympathizers trying to attack the prison or use the community of Florence as a way to get back at the detention, something they were never able to do at Gitmo.
Absolutely. That's one of the concerns. We're also concerned, frankly, about does that make, you know, particularly our children in the schools more of targets for somebody who may want to try to get a prisoner out through some other means.
So let's let them all go. I mean, they're outside this constitutional zone. They're in many ways a complete embarrassment to the U.S. judicial system. Some of the detainees do find themselves eligible for a trial. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, for instance. But why not just end this whole thing, and then you wouldn't have to deal with it, and this embarrassment for the United States would be over?
Well, again, I suspect that that's not even going to be on the table. So, and that's not something that I'm not in any position to speak about. I'm simply concerned about what's going to happen if they bring this to our community. We want to make sure our voice is heard. And I think that's our greatest frustration, is we find absolutely no information from the federal government, from the Department of Defense. We hear exclusively from our legislators. We weren't even aware this was happening until a Denver television station got in touch with us. And then our legislators quickly let us know, but they didn't know about it either. They had only had a couple hours warning before that. I cannot confirm this because they didn't bother to tell us anything, but the Department of Defense team that's reviewing this situation apparently was in Florence yesterday, and we're not allowed to know anything. We're not allowed to have any kind of input, and I think that's probably the greatest frustration. You know, political candidates and politicians always want to talk about transparency, but transparency in this particular issue is a complete joke. They haven't bothered to even reach out to the local community. In truth, for all we know, we're not actually a candidate, or for all we know, those prisoners are already here. Nothing has been communicated to us at all.
Are you basically convinced that under no circumstances you would want this to take place?
Well, I think we are definitely convinced that there are security issues, big security concerns. Our community has, between the state and federal prisons, we have 13 prisons. So we are not a NIMBY, not in my backyard kind of community. We are the kind of community that understands and accepts the reality of prisoners. So there's not no circumstances, I think, where these communities would be opposed to that. But what we're doing right now, the complete lack of information, the complete lack of working with us at all, leaves us no choice but to say, we don't want this here because we have absolutely no understanding about what this is.
Mike Patterson is city manager of Florence, Colorado, facing a difficult set of decisions and a frustrating federal government. Thanks so much, Mike.
Thank you.
Finally, the L word. When the girl punk band L7 used a lot of dirty words back in the 90s, back when the L word was a dirty word in politics, Massachusetts liberal was a slur when Michael Dukakis ran for president. As late as February 2008, President Obama defended himself against the L word during an appearance in Austin, Texas, to quote, "Oh, he's liberal," the president said, mimicking his critics. "Let me tell you something. There's nothing liberal about wanting to reduce money in politics. That's common sense. There's nothing liberal about wanting to make sure our soldiers are treated properly when they come home. There's nothing liberal about wanting to make sure that everybody has health care. But times may be changing for politicians." We could see in the debate last night that candidates were not so afraid this time around of the liberal label. The Pew Organization finds that there are now more self-identified liberals than self-identified moderates among rank-and-file Democrats. Is this changing the formula for the Democratic primary process? While the GOP must still embrace the extremes on the right, the Democrats may be getting a pass here if the L word is no longer a slur. Kathleen Hall Jamieson, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Kathleen, it's great to talk to you about this. I know you're such a language expert. Do you think there's a modification going on the word liberal in the Democratic Party?
Well, I think the first modification is the word liberal isn't usually used the way it was used in the past. When you ask people, are you conservative or liberal, you're forcing a choice. But if you listen to the debate last night, you heard the candidates self-identifying not as liberals, but as progressives.
And what does that mean?
Well, it means in practice, I think, best expressed by Barack Obama in 2012, when he said it means everybody gets a fair shot, everybody does her fair share, and everybody plays by the same rules. I think the tax and spend association with the word liberal made it harder for candidates to use it. They didn't abandon, however, the policies underlying that philosophy. I think they've just relabeled them progressive. And what you saw on the debate stage last night was a distinction between the places that Hillary Clinton is comfortable, she'll call herself a moderate or a progressive, and the place that Bernie Sanders is comfortable, he is to the left. You might say more liberal, although he calls himself a democratic socialist.
Although Jim Webb seemed to be the only one who deliberately avoided the word liberal. I'm interested in this notion of progressive because if you go back to the historical definition of progressive, I mean, it's associated with the Teddy Roosevelt days, which really involved radical change. And nobody seemed to be talking about radical change in the debate last night.
Well, you could say actually that Sanders to some extent is. And when Webb says basically to Sanders, I don't think we're going to have a revolution. I don't think we're going to pay for all these things that you're proposing. He's suggesting there's a difference in the amount and kind of change that's being proposed across the stage. But the word progressive also has another association that goes deeper into the past. Originally, philosophically, it's associated with the Enlightenment and with respect for science. And if you want to take those associations forward, and then you say, what's the divide between the Democrats and the Republicans, for example, on climate change? The word progressive is carrying some positive associations, respect for science, belief that we need to employ it in public policy.
Kathleen, let's look at this from the standpoint of how some voters identify with themselves and whether it means they're clearly identified with a particular candidate or if they're a voter in play. What would you make of this voter here?
Hi, my name is Rachel, calling from Boynton Beach, Florida. And I would definitely identify with the Liberal Democratic Party because of my values. I value a woman's choice to retain or end pregnancy, the ability for us to allow immigrants to enter the country without stigma. After all, we all are all immigrants. Civil rights for all, including gay rights and marriage. I believe our society would function better based on a socialistic format. I believe in a social safety net to protect the most vulnerable in our society. I believe in raising taxes. I'm willing to pay more to take care of the people in our nation and make the standard of living higher for low to middle class individuals.
Now, she started out solidly Hillary, but then I don't know by the end.
The fact that somebody tells you explicitly that they're comfortable with a socialistic framework, and they use that word, suggests first that Bernie Sanders is on their radar. And as a result, that they're seeing a distinction potentially between all of those things otherwise expressed and some alternative that might actually be more committed to them. Listen to those issue positions, and you'll hear no distinction that is clear between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Listen to that word, socialistic, and she's comfortable with it, and you've got a cue that she's looking at the possibility of a Sanders vote.
Just sees winnable by Sanders, but possibly comfortably in the Hillary camp unless something happens. Here's another voter.
Hi, my name is Shane Enzensberger. I'm from Sonoma, California, and I am a hardcore liberal. I believe in equitable housing, in eliminating gasoline, and I believe in a better tomorrow.
Solidly environmental. Maybe Hillary, but again, I'm thinking Sanders here.
Yeah, it's hard to tell based on very brief snippets. Here are some other questions you'd want to ask. How have you voted in the past? And then you'd look for indicator votes. So when you're, for example, in California and you've had a choice in primaries between two candidates, one further to the left than the other, where did you go? In general, one can say, except on gun control, that Hillary Clinton is the more centrist candidate. And so if you find a voting history that tips toward the left over the center in primaries, you're more likely to have a Sanders voter. But you want to know something else. You want to know whether this person cares intensely about winning general elections. And then what is the perception about whether Sanders can win? There are people who like his ideology but think he'd be sacrificed in a general election. Another McGovern-like candidacy. Agree ideologically, but you lose the White House.
Which leads us to what Anna Greenberg told us earlier in the hour. She's a Democratic pollster. She said that Democratic voters, winability trumps ideology in almost all cases for Democrats. which would suggest that both of these people are, when push comes to shove, Hillary voters.
Yeah, particularly as winnability becomes more salient. And you're beginning to hear the press ask the question of individuals in interviews whether or not they, a Democrat, believe that Sanders can win. And as they say no, they're increasing the salience of winnability as a criterion. So ask your Democratic voter if the choice is between a winnable and non-winnable candidate. If that answer becomes Hillary Clinton, ultimately, any place in a gray zone, assume you've got a Hillary Clinton vote.
All right. I'm thinking that's a great question for right after the New Hampshire primary. But we'll let them just sort of talk idly for now and not try to hold their feet to the fire. But by primary time, I think it's going to be time for some very, very interesting, what would we call it, spectography to see how some of these colors shake out.
Yeah, and there's such a thing as voting as an act of expression. So, you know, in a primary, you're actually able to do that if you don't believe that you are decisive in determining who's ultimately going to be the winner. So you get some signaling voting that just says, look, I think my party should be here. I'm going to cast the vote for the person I really think should be elected, even though I know ultimately if this were in the general election, I'd prefer the other candidate up there representing my party because that candidate can win. You're going to see more of that kind of voting early in the process rather than later.
Kathleen Hall Jamison, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Do you identify as liberal, conservative, or somewhere in between?
This is Clay from Mount Laurel, New Jersey. I'm definitely conservative because I believe the government is way too inefficient to run social programs. I donate directly to several charities, and I get to see my impact dollar for dollar. The government loses 60 to 80 cents on the dollar in interest and overhead before it can even begin to help. We can do better.
New York, New York. I'm an atheist, quasi-liberal from the Bible Belt with Southern tendencies and a small but firm libertarian streak. Go Mets. Thanks for that. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.